What happened?
Well, he's waving his hands. You gotta wait.
What is this, a live performance?
Yes. It's from Staatsoper Berlin. Are you hearing it?
Yeah.
All right, everybody. As this thing gets fired up, it's Tuesday, February 27th, 2024. We're just listening to the opening music of the Leonard Tell Show. It's called Les Préludes. Daniel Barenboim mit Berlin Philharmoniker of Berlin.
You don't really listen to classical music at all, do you?
Not lately, no.
Right. None of you people listen to classical music. All you know is a shitty, shitty pop music. Right?
Well,
I'm going to come down on people now.
I listen to podcasts. When does this pick up? Where's the bridge on this?
You haven't the patience for it.
Well, listen, we're in 1 minute and 30 seconds. It's 17 minutes long.
Well.
When does the disc jockey come in? All right, I'm just joking around.
No, this is important. Because when the movement to censor rock and roll records took place in the 1990s, Al Gore, here it is.
Yes.
Turn up the volume.
Well, I got it on max here. Well, wait, no, here we go. Sorry about that.
Franz Liszt was the guy who discovered Wagner. And Wagner married his daughter. Crank it up.
I got it on 11.
That'll do for now.
All right. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. That's 3 minutes into 3 minutes and 22 seconds.
And worth every second of it.
And worth every second. Right. I heard that they play this kind of music in areas where there's a lot of crime. And the crooks, they just disappear. They scatter like bugs. Why is that?
I don't know. I never heard that.
You haven't heard that? That's cool. I think they were doing that in the New York City subway.
Well, I'm sure it helps to listen to classical music. Yeah, some of it.
So but, is this food for the soul?
Yeah, you could call it that, but it's a cut above. I mean, look.
It is lovely.
I got nothing against rock and roll. And to tell you the truth, there are a number of very competent, classically trained musicians who cross over into popular music, and they create very original sounds. But if I could take you back to the movement to censor heavy metal and hard rock.
Okay, when was that? That's on the Fakeologist forums. You're going to bring up one of your posts?
No, I mean, we should all remember this if we're Americans, but you wouldn't remember it. You're Canadian. What do you care?
Yeah.
You don't remember Al Gore's wife, Tipper Gore?
Yes, I remember her.
Organizing a movement. That ended up basically, you know, those labels you see.
Yeah, it was labeling for to censor. It was mainly rap.
Her target was like death metal, satanic metal. That was her main target. Rap was mentioned a lot,
right?
But I think it was mainly hard rock. That most of the examples they brought to the table and. It ended up, the compromise was you saw that sticker on album covers.
Right, the sticker on album covers, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. It says, yeah, you can turn off that background music unless you want to listen to it.
No, I want to listen to the Leonard Tell on the Leonard Tell Show.
I mean...
yeah, Sorry, we can listen to music all night.
I was really stunned by this thing because, and of course, it's Al Gore and his wife Tipper that were behind this.
Right.
These really scummy people.
They're since divorced or split up.
I guess so. Yeah.
Yeah.
What did he took off with a masseuse? Is that what he did? I don't know. Anyway.
Well, it wasn't explained, but I don't think she could stand. There's only room for one ego in that 7,000 square foot house.
So two people came to testify before the United States Senate in defense of their industry. Dee Snider of Twisted Sister.
Oh, right. He's controlled opposition.
Right. And Frank Zappa.
Right.
Frank Zappa. And I will never forget what Frank Zappa said to these senators. He really put them in their place. Very articulate. Actually, that video is probably out on YouTube somewhere.
Here it is here, but we'll look at this. Here we are. Here's your buddy Dee Snider there. What a freak show. And suggestive lyrics from the likes of Madonna and Twisted Sister and Twisted Sister led to a Senate hearing on whether musicians should be allowed to rock without parental supervision. Wow.
Yeah, parental supervision. That was the issue. So I really liked what Zappa said because he said, look, he said, I don't know why you guys are singling out rock music, he says. I know none of you mentioned country music, which is written by people who have been to prison and are proud of it. And it's full of infidelity and, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff.
Frank Zappa said it's like treating dandruff with decapitation.
Yeah. Yeah. And he also, and here's was his advice to these people.
Yeah.
He said, instead of running around trying to censor music.
Yeah.
American parents should be introducing their children to the wide spectrum of available music, such as classical music, jazz, right, folk music, bluegrass. But Zappa particularly emphasized classical music because he had been trained in classical music.
The next witness will be Mr. Frank Zappa.
Hard to believe they actually had Senate hearings on this. Forget about JFK. Let's go right for rock and roll.
Well, this was the 90s. But you're right. Oliver Stone's movie JFK was released in 91. And then Clinton came in 92. You would have thought they would have been talking about that, but you're right. Instead, this is what they chose to focus on.
I think more people could identify with it, probably. Frank Zappa has a Syrian look. He kind of looks like Bashir al-Assad.
Yeah. A skinny version of it.
Well, Bashir al-Assad is skinny.
Yeah, I don't know. This is going to take so long. But go ahead.
Well, I'm just playing a bit. I want to hear if he has something, how he opens it up. Order in the court.
Mr. Zappa, thank you very much for being with us. Please proceed.
Okay, my name is Frank Zappa. This is my attorney, Larry Stein, Los Angeles. Can you hear me?
If you could speak very directly and clearly into the microphone, I'd appreciate it.
Yes. My name is Larry Stein.
Larry Stein, from the tribe.
The statement that I prepared that I sent you 100 copies of is 5 pages long, so I have shortened it down, and I'm going to read a condensed version of it. Certain things have happened. I've been listening to the event in the other room, and I've heard some conflicting reports as to whether or not people in this committee want legislation. I understand Mr. Hollings does from his comments. Is that correct?
I think you better concentrate on your testimony rather than asking questions of the
committee. The reason I need to ask is because I have to change something in my testimony if So if there is not a clear-cut version of whether or not legislation is what is being discussed here.
Do the best you can because I don't think anybody here can characterize Senator Hollings' position.
Okay, well, I'll carry on with the...
Oh, he starts off with a question and gets derailed right away. Okay, well, do you want to hear more?
It's not necessary to repeat what Zappa said. He was very articulate.
He's a very smart guy.
Right. But his point was, if you parents were exposing your kids to a wider variety of music, and especially classical music and classical American jazz,
right,
you know, then you'd be giving them a real cultural background, and you wouldn't have to worry about them, you know, getting into, well, it was his whole question about this whole thing about, we don't want school kids reading porn in school. Well, yeah, that's a problem now, but how many of them graduate and can read at all? You understand? If you taught basic literacy, you wouldn't have to have sex education in the schools. Kids could read it in books. That's where I got my sex education from, at the library. Of course, I could read before I even started school.
I got mine from the Happy Hooker.
Well, that would have been a little bit later, maybe, but...
Xavier Hollander.
Yeah, I remember her.
Yeah, all right. I just want
to... So anyway... that's kind of how I feel when I hear people get really deep into, like, Mike Williams and the Beatles. Oh, the Beatles. Ah, they're so, I'm so fixated on them. No, the Beatles were just like the Monkees. They might have been a little bit more talented.
Yeah.
There wasn't any difference between the Beatles and the Monkees. So Mike Williams, what are you getting your panties in a wad about, you know? It's not like these guys were a string quartet playing Mozart or Haydn, or a full orchestra playing Richard Strauss or Wagner or Beethoven, or a keyboard virtuoso playing a toccata by Johann Sebastian Bach. That is real talent. That is real art. Not most popular music. You understand?
Yeah.
Most rock and roll is, it's, they're three chord wonders. I hate to get into this, but so yeah, and I'm not, once again, I don't want to sound like a snob here, but it's like people who are apparent experts in the Bible, but they don't know that it wasn't originally written in English, because all they've ever looked at is the King James, or the Revised Standard, or I don't know, the NIV, the New International Version, became very popular with the Jesus freaks in the 80s and 90s. But if you said, well, what language was it originally written in? And they might guess Hebrew or Greek. They might. It's this United States of shallow. That's how I think about it. The United States of shallow.
Yeah. All right. Well, yeah. Let's.
Why I make a point here, because I posted in the forums.
Okay. You can show your screen now.
There's a chat section.
Yeah. Fakeologistforums.com. Anyone wants to sign up, you can. Make sure you give me an email when you sign up to the Fakeologist Forums, please, so I know that you're not a bot. I get a lot of bots trying to register. So make sure you send me an email at ima@fakeologist.com. And let me know you tried to sign up, if you would. And Lynn is on there a lot. We appreciate that.
I posted a link to a video. And wow, it's like, let me see if I can reposition this, because the...
Yeah, just lower the, it's a little too big. Just press control negative on your number pad there to lower the size there.
Wow. I got to zoom out, you mean? All right.
Yeah, zoom out a bit. I think you're zoomed in a bit.
Yeah, it still does the same thing, but that's all right.
All right. Well, just give me what you got.
Yeah.
There.
It's basically blocked out by the head.
No, I'll turn off the chat.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Here we go.
I could turn off all the, things here.
So I posted a link to a video on why music has gotten so lousy.
Yeah.
And it reviews the history of the consolidation of AM and FM radio, especially since the Communications Act of 1996. It actually, first, the YouTube video reviews the history of the FCC and the manner in which media has been controlled from the very beginning.
Okay.
Electronic media, beginning with radio and television. But he explains how basically two or three companies now control just about all the music. All the music that's commercially available on the radio. And they program it. It's completely centralized. It's not like it was when I was growing up and you had local DJs that belong to your community and your neighborhood. It's nothing like that now. And then I also posted a link because I think part of this situation, the responsibility for this situation, lies with the performers themselves, the singers and the musicians, who as people seem to have devolved into lower and lower, lower quality human beings, more stupid, less talented, more greedy, and more opportunist, more willing to sell out. And I post a link there to an interview that Joe Rogan just did with Kid Rock. Or I should call him Kid Shit for Brains Rock.
Yeah, what's the guy's real name?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know what his real name is, but I should look it up, you know. But anybody who hasn't heard the video, basically.
Robert James Ritchie.
Okay.
He's a real winner.
Well, this is the kind of stuff that a lot of people never even bother listening to. It's always been mediocre.
Oh, yeah.
But this Kid Rock, this describes perfectly his mentality. When the vaccines came out, he was one of the first to tweet, oh, I'm going to take this shot. Why not? With all the drugs I'm putting in my body, you know, what's the risk of one more shot?
Yeah, there's some logic to that.
Yeah, right. So he was pro-vax in the beginning.
Is that on your screen now? Or you're just...
The link to that interview with him is on there.
Okay, scroll down a bit. I can't see that on the screen.
I can't get the full screen. I can't scroll on that. Oh, I see what you're saying.
You go to the tab and just scroll down and show us what you're talking
about. Yeah, I'll bring up the video.
Well, there we go.
Oh, I got to jump to the post. Wait a minute.
Yeah, jump to the post. Yeah.
Right.
Psychologistforums.com. It's a very good, fast website.
So if I'm still sharing the screen, can you see?
Yeah, I see it. We're all looking at Bill Clinton.
Yeah, well, that was part of it. Mm-hmm. This Telecommunications Act of 1996. Like, America must have been sleeping when they passed this thing. It just removed all trace of competition. And the other thing is this big lie they call net neutrality. Do we have to explain that to people?
I've listened a couple times on the No Agenda show to them explain it, and I'm still confused.
It's a Trojan horse. It's all about centralized government, corporate control.
Oh, okay.
So here's the clip of Kid Rock. You want me to play it? We'll see if I could actually play something here. I don't know.
Go ahead. You're on Palestine This Week. Listen to the podcast.
I don't disagree with what Israel's doing.
Can you hear
that?
Just
go in there and be like, you know what? We want our hostages back. If we don't have them back, clock starts now in fucking 24 hours. We're going to start bombing motherfuckers and killing fucking civilians. 30, 40,000 a fucking time. So you civilians better fucking pack up and fucking get these fucking motherfuckers and you go against Hamas. You fucking go against them. We're not playing fucking games with you. But that's the only thing people understand. This is what happened in Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
So more lies on lies. Wow.
Yeah, this Kid Rock. Kid Shit for Brains Rock.
Jay, what's the call-in number? Look at the scroll on the bottom of the screen. Those are phone numbers. 810-666-1984. 902-400-1984. Join the studio at fake11.com/restream. Yeah, so he's propagating the phony baloney hostage story.
As if that wasn't bad enough. Mm-hmm. He's got it. And this is an important moment to stop and make a point, because I'm constantly flogging this idea, this French postmodernist idea from Jean Baudrillard called the simulacrum, based on his work, Simulation and Simulacrum. This Kid Rock statement saying, let's kill 30 or 40,000 civilians. Now, nobody's done that yet. But what I would say in response to all the fake videos we've seen coming out of Gaza and the possibility we have to consider that nobody has really been killed there, that's a very radical thing to say to people.
Yeah.
I'm sure most people are convinced that somebody's been killed there.
Well, they believe in the hostages and they believe in the Palestinian genocide.
Right. And if you believe strongly enough, you may actually go out and bomb somebody or kill somebody.
Yes, this is the danger.
Because
these guys that rule over us, they always make us make our own decisions. They don't do their own killing. And that's what we were talking about. They always incite. They're the ones that incite the violence and start the killing.
But the point I'm making here is that when we say this is a hoax or this is a simulation, at a certain point, the effect of it really renders that irrelevant. Once the Spanish-American War started, no one was going to go back and look at the explosion on the battleship Maine and figure it was an inside job, or maybe it was completely faked. It's too late at that point. Once the real shooting has started,
yeah,
the fact that it might be based on a false flag, I know people hate that term,
right?
But a simulation that is designed to frame someone or create a scapegoat or point blame at a nation state or a religion or a racial group,
yes,
falsely, which we recognize as a blood libel. That's what Jews call it. Jews call it a blood libel. It's the worst form of bearing false witness, which is the violation of the Ninth Commandment. The worst form of it. Because it can lead to real bloodshed.
Right.
And that's why I'm never satisfied when people say it was a hoax. Because it could turn out to be, it always is a criminal hoax. And it can lead to real suffering, real violence, real war, real bloodshed. It really can happen. So that's what Kid Rock to me points that up. I mean, he's probably too old and not in physical shape to put on a uniform and carry an AR-15 or whatever they're armed with, whatever the NATO round is these days.
Yeah.
But you've got all these young people in uniform in the military and they'll go wherever they're told.
Yes.
Wherever they're told. You had a caller talking about this, calling in from Arkansas, from Bentonville, Arkansas, gave us a whole rundown on the
Dookie the Walmart, foot.
Yeah, on the Walmart and all that.
Yeah, that was interesting. It was getting good.
And when he got to the part where he was talking about these young people, who they're just like in high school, 17, 18, here, sign on the dotted line. And he said, we've got to get them to understand, when you do that, you're selling your soul to these gangsters. Oh, I couldn't say it better.
Yeah,
but that's good. But what does it mean? It means that you're willing to bomb people, to shoot people, to drone people. Nowadays, it's all going to be drones.
Yes.
Nowadays, a military recruit is just as likely to be sitting in front of a screen with a keyboard and a joystick in front of them, in a trailer outside Vegas somewhere, remotely guiding drones in Syria or Afghanistan or Yemen or wherever they're sending them. So the detachment now from the act of killing and the actual blood, you know, you're like a 2,000 miles away, 3,000 miles away.
Yeah.
So it's become very abstract. And that is the nature of the simulacrum. At a certain point, you've created a reality that has nothing to do with its reason for existence. There may be no rational reason for the existence of this physical phenomenon. But, you know, it's still real. So now we're told, and the country seems to be in an uproar. Oh, and before I finish with that. Tonight, yeah. I was listening to NPR, their nightly news.
Okay.
They did an extended interview with an IDF soldier who I'm pretty sure they indicated had dual British and Israeli citizenship. Certainly had the British accent. And they played, his job was to be on the, he's in media, that's his job. His job was to be on the ground taking camera footage of what was going on in Gaza. In particular, the Israeli army's assault on the tunnels in a place called Far Yunis, somewhere like that in Gaza. Okay. Yunis, whatever.
To propagate the tunnel story.
Yeah, right. They were blowing up a tunnel.
Those
and
damn
you
tunnels.
Could hear them all yelling and high-fiving each other. Woo! You know, as they blew up this tunnel. And he realized how inappropriate it sounded if this really was a combat situation. And you could almost hear him have to explain away. He says, well, you know, we were really happy because we collapsed this tunnel. And any Hamas terrorists that were underneath the tunnel, we knew we got rid of them. That's what he was saying. And I kept thinking to myself as I was listening to this. This IDF guy, he's not stupid. He knows this is all a freaking lie. They may not have even been armed with real ammunition. They may have been armed with what's called simunition.
Right, simunition,
fake, yeah. Yeah, fake rounds.
We talked about that, yeah.
But listening to the interview with this guy with his perfect British accent, and I don't know if he was even a real IDF propagandist or not. I have no idea what his real identity is. But I began to think to myself, what evil people there are in this world that would try to gaslight us in this way, that would produce these media fictions that propagate these false narratives, and they know exactly what they're doing. It tears my head apart trying
Marcus
to...
Marcus Raybaugh calls it the cult of Judah. You ever heard of that?
Well, Judah... Okay. Mm-hmm. That's just a name you're giving to something, okay?
Yeah.
You know what Judah means? You know what Yehuda means? You know what Yehuda is?
Well, I think he's explained it, but go ahead.
You're not a Bible guy either, are you?
No. I'm a fakeologist.
Right. And I guess you figured a Bible's a little bit fake too, huh?
Go ahead.
Right. Yehuda happens to be the largest tribe among the 12 tribes of Israel.
Ever heard of the 12 tribes of Israel? Yeah, I've heard of that.
Right. If you do read the Bible, the way the narrative works is this. Judah, there is no J.
Yes, there's no J. I knew
in
that.
Hebrew. This is more butchering of Hebrew and Greek by this fucked up pig language called English. Which I despise.
What's your favorite language, Lynn?
Wait a minute, you want to know why I despise English?
Go.
I was spelling bee champion. National spelling bee champion. That should be no surprise to you because I read a lot of books.
Wow. Why are the Indians taking over on that now?
Right. Until about the eighth grade of high school, which was my first year of Spanish. And then I realized how stupid spelling bees were, because there are no spelling bees in Spanish-speaking countries.
Okay, why?
Well, think about it. Do you know anything about Spanish?
I know about some of the Romance languages, yes. France,
right.
French, yeah.
Spanish and Italian in particular are unambiguous in their spelling. English spelling, as you know, has all kinds of homonyms.
I was just going to say the word homonyms.
Right. But that's not the case in the Roman with I can't speak for French because French spelling is very strange.
There are no homonyms in Spanish.
There might be, yes, there might be spellings that sound the same. It's very rare. In Spanish, if you know how to pronounce something, you know how to spell it. I challenge you to find any word in Spanish which has an ambiguous spelling as we have in English. Because Spanish was codified in very, very early in the 16th century by the Habsburg rulers of Spain, which then became part of the Holy Roman Empire. And they established an academy to standardize the spelling of the language and the grammar. This was at least 200, 300 years before the standardization of English. I tell you again, English is a bastard language, a very contrived bastard language. It originates from the Normans that conquered England, and they invented English, essentially. They were French speakers. They were Vikings who had settled in northern France, Normandy, and learned French and become Frenchified and converted to Christianity and developed a relationship with the Pope and everything else. And when they conquered England, after the Pope granted England to the Normans, to William the Bastard or William the Conqueror, once they conquered England to communicate with these Anglo-Saxon speaking peasants who they were ruling over, they developed this sort of pidgin language that had elements of French, elements of Latin, and elements of the old Anglo-Saxon. And it's come to be called English. But the language never got standardized. The first English dictionaries weren't until the late 18th century, whereas the Spanish already had a dictionary by about 1500. Same thing with the Italians standardized their languages, their language, Italian, with Petrarch and Dante and Boccaccio, three greatest writers in the Italian language. But it's very hard to explain to you unless you're familiar with Spanish. But if you have any Spanish speakers in your audience, they'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Why, if you go to a Spanish-speaking country, they don't have spelling bees. They would laugh at the idea because there's never any ambiguity or doubt about how to spell.
Everyone knows how to spell
Spanish.
Yeah.
What's that?
Everyone knows how to spell.
Well, everyone knows how to spell because the word is spelled exactly
as it sounds,
like it's
yeah.
pronounced, right?
Yeah, yeah, I understand. I get that. That's interesting.
Whereas English is
why are all the best spelling beers now Indian? It seems. Do they have some kind of memory retention or?
Well, it's like why do the Asians score better on math tests?
No, they just study harder, I guess.
Yeah, I think they study harder, and also the Chinese have had the abacus. You know, they've been doing arithmetic for a long time.
Yeah, that's true.
But there—I don't know. There could be a genetic explanation too. I don't think so. I think it's mostly cultural.
Yeah, I believe in the cultural thing too.
Yeah,
yeah.
But I when I realized this, by about my first year studying Spanish, I said, "Boy, English is a stupid language. English spelling is asinine." You know, how embarrassing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So,
hey, by the way, we're taking callers tonight, 810-666-1984, 902-400-1984. If you had any questions for Lynn, we're in the back half of the show now, so call in while you can. Secure a line. Just let the phone. Actually, we have the answering service on now, and it should even tell you what number you are in queue. That's if you call the main phone numbers. Otherwise, call us on Skype at Fakeologist, and you can join the studio at fake11.com/restream. Will you take calls, Lynn?
Sure. I always love calls. Yeah.
Well,
we
yeah.
You have a very educated audience.
You've always been a caller in or inner, and now you're the host. Looks like we've got somebody on the line now. Hello, caller. Where are you calling from?
12 seconds.
Hello, caller. Where are you calling from?
This is Willard calling from Florida.
Hi, Willard. You're a regular on the Lynn or Tell show, I think.
Yes, I've been listening to her ever since she called in to Chris Kendall at Hoax Busters.
That's a long time ago. That's like 10 years ago. Yeah, come on.
I had like two questions. One, do you remember Dave McGowan?
Of course. He wrote about
weird scenes inside the canyon. Go ahead.
Right. Well, he started off writing about serial killers.
Right. Programmed to kill, huh?
Yeah. I don't think he caught on to the idea that it might all be fake, though. His idea was they were covering up certain real serial killers And some of the ones they were putting out there were crisis, were like actors. Or it was a very strange analysis that he had. But I don't think he was moving in the direction of deconstructing the whole serial killer narrative as fundamentally fake. But he hadn't yet arrived at that. Now, his work on Laurel Canyon, that's pretty interesting. Yeah. And that, by the way, joins up with Joseph Atwill's Manufacturing the Deadhead. I know.
Yes.
Like Don Averato had Joe Atwill on. Well, that was to discuss Caesar's Messiah. But
yeah,
his work on Manufacturing the Deadhead is even more impressive, I think, because... And he did a lot of this with Jan Ervin, who's kind of gone off the deep end, Jan Ervin. But as Joe Atwill explains it, the whole hippie movement was the result of this project undertaken by people like Gregory Bateson and Margaret Mead, and Timothy Leary was in the crowd, you know, a whole bunch of them. And that it really was cultural engineering. But go ahead, make the point you were going to make, Willard, about Dave McGowan.
Well, there's two of them. One is with Facebook. He opened his page there, and I began to post there. And, you know, he wrote about Wagon the Moon Dog, the fake moon landing.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
And then he wrote about the Boston bombing, you know, as being fake. And I would, on the post, I would broach these other topics about fakery, and I would get banned. I'd go to the website, Facebook, and I would get a screen that would say, we need your social security number, date of birth, blah, blah, blah. And he would routinely ban me. Have you ever heard of that on Facebook, where they would ask you get a screen that tells you need that information before you can get back on?
Wow.
So he didn't like the idea. See, so he couldn't handle criticism. That's kind of sad in a way.
It was really strange, because I would get a response from his other posters. I would say, for example, at one post I said, okay, Dave, you're saying that they faked the moon landing and they faked the Boston bombing, but in between those two events, no fakery took place. That's, you know, am I supposed to believe that they just stopped doing it? But it's like you said, it was a kind of a strange analysis, and certain fake ideas, he wouldn't go there.
Wow.
He had too much invested. He had too much invested in his MSM plus narrative.
Yeah, good point.
That's exactly the problem.
Now, what about the Facebook because it happened to me several times and I'd have to create another account. Have you had that since you've been managing the Facebook account for Fakeologists?
Well, quite a few years back, I was completely banned by Facebook. So I started a whole new account. So I've already been through, and I've been subject to periodic lockdowns on Facebook where they say you can't post in a group for 30 days. You know?
Yeah.
You can post anywhere else, but you can't post in a group. Or you cannot comment or reply for 30 days. I've gotten a lot of those.
It's probably changed. But that was 2014 when this happened, and I don't know if he was the one instigating it or Facebook, where they would require this personal information from me before I could go back on.
It's hard to say whether it was a Facebook algorithm that was tracking you or really McGowan himself. How would you know?
Right, because he had a strange guy that kind of researched my background, and he was kind of like a doppelganger for him at the time. So, but that gets to the second question I had about McGowan, his thesis of these musicians, you know, clustering in Laurel Canyon. Do you think that was a legit analysis, or was it more the baby boomers were a militarized society, so it's not unusual to have a background in the military? Because everybody I know practically when I was growing up had parents in the military. My own folks were.
Well, that's like we had a caller the other night, Brian, who said he found a listing on LinkedIn for me because I had worked for Lockheed Martin. Well, yeah, that's right. I did. I worked for Lockheed Martin for about it was really remarkable because I never expected it was a Social Security complex. Hey, Brian, I probably helped process your Social Security claim.
That's what it was about. That's what Lockheed Martin was doing.
Don't you guys know they're everywhere? There's millions of people that work for them now.
Nice.
You can't have a job doing anything that has anything to do with computers unless you're working for one of these big corporations, even if you're subcontracting. In this case, I was there. I worked for this small mom and pop firm of about 35 people. And I was what you call a third party subcontractor. So my boss worked for Lockheed Martin, Assad Hussein. And my boss, Assad Hussein, called me in one day and said, "We want you on the team." And I laughed and said, "There's no way in hell you're going to get me any kind of security clearance." He said, "All you need is a public trust clearance and I can get it for you." And he did. And you know what I did, Brian? I processed your Social Security claim. What do you think of that? I guess that makes me a CIA agent, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, you're funny.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's what McGowan's guilty of, is that, you know, we're a militarized society, and he's MSN plus, as you say. And he just kind of was spinning a narrative, but not to have any integrity with the fakeology points on his part. I just don't get it. Guys like him, man, why don't you go all the way? Because he talked to Chris Kendall on that. He should know better.
Yeah, that was just ego on his part, right?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, he was getting something of a following with Wag the Moon Doggy and his stuff on serial killers. So,
yeah,
and you know, that's kind of sad.
Makes you wonder about this latest land.
Mittens is back to feeling good with our weight management.
This latest moon landing here. Here's a story. Says, makes you wonder why 1972's moon landing is more clear than the one from this year, 2003 or whatever. Or didn't they just land? What was the latest fake story? There we go.
Yeah, they're claiming that the lunar lander toppled over.
Right. No, here's 1972 on the screen, and they're saying it's more clear than the latest fake moon landing, which is I'm going to show here, 2023. Actually, here we go. So what's going on? Why are the videos getting worse?
Well, the analysis that we get from Infinite Plane Radio is that they have a real problem with the fact that many of the Hollywood special effects used in movies are more realistic than the crap that NASA's been producing.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they can't introduce the cutting edge digital simulation right away, or the glaring contrast between the current state of the art and this old crap that they put out would be so obvious that it would already discredit the old material. I mean, who's going to look at something from either 69 or 72 and compare it to something that's being produced now and not see how inferior the old stuff is? So it's maintaining that continuity, that continuity of the images themselves and the special effects. And yes, theoretically, they will reach a point where the simulation will be enough to fool anybody. But of course, what does that mean exactly, to fool somebody? It's like, how would you know what the moon really looks like anyway? Like, any simulation will do, won't it? What's the difference?
Yeah.
That's a good point.
You know?
Well, thanks a lot, Lynn. That was all I had for the questions. Enjoy listening to you. I'll let you go.
Yeah, I'm going to go back and take a second look at Dave McGowan, because, as I say, I felt like he should have gone back and revised his view on serial killers once he realized, as you say, if this is fake and that is fake, well, what makes you think they just started faking yesterday? You know, like Donald Trump says, oh, it's the fake news. Oh, really, Mr. President? When did it start being the fake news? Just when you ran for president, or has it always been the fake news?
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember, but he was one of the first ones that wrote an article about Columbine. McGowan was. And he had a serious
And he thought it was real.
Oh, yeah.
Did he think it was real?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. And he has this sharp mind, his analytical, but yet
gatekeeper.
He missed these obvious contradictions. Yeah.
Well,
right.
Gatekeeper or a blind spot. A blind spot, right. Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
You know what that blind spot is? It's ego. It's ego.
He did
it's
have
someone not willing to admit they were.
Right. Yeah.
And as I say, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Fool me three times, four or five, it means somebody loves to be fooled. That's all that's happening. Some people are committed to being
George
fooled.
Bush could not get that quote right.
Yeah.
Got to catapult the propaganda.
Now watch this shot. Yeah, we got a lot of funny George Bush sound bites here.
You know, have you seen the video of when he was governor and how he's a lucid, articulate, intelligent speaker? And then you contrast that when he was president. And that speaks a lot to this idea of them being actors.
Yeah.
And playing a role. George Bush Jr., I'm saying, not
Shrub.
Yeah.
Shrub.
Yeah, Shrub, right. Yeah, because I've seen him interviewed when he was governor, and he comes across completely different than when he was president. You know, just, you know, projecting a totally different image.
Well, I heard a recent speech he gave to a crowd where instead of saying, he was talking about Russia invading Ukraine, and instead he said, invaded Iraq. And then he caught himself and said, I mean Ukraine. And the whole audience broke out laughing.
And so he was super embarrassed.
He's still doing that stuff. He's still doing that.
Yeah.
I'm trying to find all my George W. Bush clips, my sound effects. Oh,
yeah, they would kind of project him as like a buffoon. Remember, they showed him at a state dinner, like talking with his mouth full and chomping away at the corner of his mouth and being sort of a bore. But there's other footage of him being, you know, the polished, yuppie, waspy guy he is, the family came from.
He was known to be an obnoxious drunk and also total cokehead. You know, you had college buddies of his who came out and said, oh yeah, George could really put it away, he could really put that white powder away. So
that's just more hearsay and all that.
It was kind of well known. I mean, it was talked about. I think they cultivated these ideas because they wanted to make him seem more human. They did that with Bill Clinton, right?
Oh, I got a couple sound effects of his. Here we go.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores. Some people call you the elite. I call you my base.
All right, a little bit of George there, Bush. That's George W. Bush, Shrub. Yeah, so we have a couple of his. All right, well, thanks for calling in. I really appreciate it. Willard, keep listening.
Yes, sir. Y'all take care.
All right, have a good night. There goes Willard from Florida. All right, we got about 10 minutes left. Do you want to cover anything in particular there?
Yeah, I want to address this historical revisionism question, because I don't do analysis of images. I'm just not talented at that. Mm-hmm. I've never done video editing. You know, I've taken too many hallucinogenics anyway. So, you know,
yeah, I got a clip from Dave McGowan on Kennedy. Do you want to hear that?
Yeah, play that.
Literally, yes. A member of the family had died. And so I remember, you know, I can remember their reaction to it, and to some extent, my older brothers. So even though I wasn't old enough to really understand at all, I knew on some level that something really, really, really bad had happened, but I did not understand what it was until much later. But yeah, it was just such a, it had such an impact on my family. My family are very, very, very devout Democrats, pretty much have been for, you know, very long time. And they're also Catholic. So they definitely felt a real affinity for John Kennedy. So,
well, I think he was the most beloved of all American presidents, actually.
Oh, of course it has to be Fetzer talking about it.
Yeah, I actually think that's one of the reasons that he was killed, that maybe not one of the reasons that he was killed, I guess, but I think Americans were very much encouraged to look upon him with great affection and as almost a family member. And I think they really wanted the country to bond with him so that it would be as traumatic as possible when he was, you know, taken away. It was sort of a conditioning exercise to some
extent. All right, that's not very interesting. I'll put the kibosh on that one there. All right.
Well, it shows he can be fooled.
Yeah. All right, what else you got?
Well, historical revisionism.
Okay, I like that.
As I say, I'm not into image deconstruction, although some images are obviously fake.
Okay.
What I look at is documentary evidence.
Okay.
And in particular, the internal coherence and language and details of documents and whether they're internally consistent, whether the narrative makes any sense, or whether there's clear evidence of forgery in a document.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if someone presents to me a document that they say originated in the 12th century, and it refers to the fall of Constantinople, well, I know that's bullshit, because the Constantinople didn't fall until 1453. You understand?
Yeah.
In other words, it's a bad forgery. It's a shitty forgery. And we see these all the time. I will give you several examples. One is the Gleason map. The Gleason map, if you look at it, not only has all kinds of crude misspellings of locations, but it actually has the names of wrong names of cities. It has cities in the wrong place. So this thing obviously was forged and created in order to discredit flat earthers and make them look stupid and illiterate. And there's an excellent deconstruction of this by Lori Frary and Lawrence Wright of the Flat Earth Conspiracy. And they spend like 2 hours going through this, dissecting the original Gleason map and showing how it's clearly a modern forgery that's been planted so that flat earthers will pick it up and run with it and end up looking like idiots. And they make a very strong case for that. Now, what am I getting at here? The birth of modernity is generally tracked to the mid-15th century, the 1400s, and in particular to a deconstruction of a fake document that is probably the most important exposure of a fake document in the history of our civilization. So, for example, we know that, to credit David Irving, when the Hitler diaries came out, a lot of British historians were fooled. A lot of German historians were fooled. H.R. Trevor Roper, sort of the dean of British historians, he thought they were authentic. But David Irving, to his credit, looked at the language, looked at the way it was written, and said, well, number one, at the time one of these entries was written, the attempt to assassinate Hitler had occurred, and he had suffered an injury from the explosion. His arm had been injured, his right arm, and so he couldn't have written this personally. But then Irving went ahead and pointed out various linguistic anomalies, and this is what computer analysis is going to be great for. We're going to be, in the future, we're going to be able to take text and run them through detailed computer analysis, and they're going to be able to tell you from the style alone of the language, whether only one author wrote it, whether several authors wrote it, right? what sort of models they had for the style of writing they used. And so this is what kind of what I'm getting at here is the most important such, how do I put this, auto hoaxing of a document occurred in the mid 15th century. And the document was something called the Donation of Constantine. We can only trace the existence of this document back to the time of the Carolingians, Charlemagne, which in conventional dating would be about the year 800. Mm-hmm. Historically, Charlemagne was crowned Augustus in the West by the Pope on Christmas Day, 800 AD. And to some extent, the church, the Donation of Constantine purports to be the deeding of the city of Rome to the papacy and the papal states, the surrounding territories, by the Emperor Constantine the Great. It's the single document that makes Rome, the papacy, the Vatican, a legitimate heir of the Roman Empire. Lorenzo Valla, an expert in Greek, Latin, other languages, deconstructed the Donation of Constantine and showed from the language and some of the terms that were used that it had been written much, much later and that it was clearly a forgery. And everyone pretty much had to admit this was the case. Even the church had to admit it was the case. But the impact it had intellectually throughout Europe was like a thunderbolt, because the church, the infallibility of the Holy See was forever wrecked and destroyed. And so Lorenzo Valla's exposure of the Donation of Constantine as a forgery, in a way, indirectly led to the movements that became the Protestant Reformation, to Jan Hus in Czechoslovakia, who challenged the idea that the Pope was the vicar of Christ on earth, Martin Luther in Germany in about 1517, even before that, John Wycliffe in England. So this was a Lorenzo Valla's exposure of the Donation of Constantine as a forgery is the most important, how do you put it, a bit of fakeology in the history of civilization up to that point. And I think we should adhere to that standard. I think we should use that as a standard for analyzing documents and documentary evidence. We should see where documents contradict each other, where one individual gives a different account than another, and we should compare them. And we should see, one of the things I do and that historians have done is they've looked at competing sources. So, for example, they would look at Chinese historians writing at the same time as ancient Roman historians about an event like Halley's Comet or a great earthquake or the plague of Justinian or the Black Death of the Middle Ages, which was reported throughout Asia and Europe. So we know something happened and we can compare those accounts. In modern times, we've had this explosion of forgeries. It's a business. And the Pike-Mazzini letter is one example of such an obvious forgery. Because when we trace its origins, the place there at its first referenced and quoted from is a Canadian researcher from the Canadian intelligence community at the height of the Cold War in 1956. Whose name is Guy Carr, C-A-R-R.
Okay.
He is the first one to reference the Pike-Mazzini letter and make claims about it. And then he, in turn, attributes his sources to, a Benedictine monk, some Cistercian monk.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the Pike-Mazzini letter, it's ridiculous. For one thing, they use words like Zionism. The word Zionism wasn't even used until into the 1890s.
Right.
Actually, the term Zionism originated from Theodor Herzl, who was a journalist, in direct response to the espionage charges and frame-up of Captain Alfred Dreyfus in the French army. Dreyfus was accused of being a spy and selling secrets to the Germans. It was a total frame up. The evidence against him was very poor. It was that they're actually covering up for another officer named Esterhazy, who subsequently fled the country. But Dreyfus was condemned and sentenced to Devil's Island. And a national crusade started in France to free Dreyfus that he was innocent. And it involved the very famous French novelist Emile Zola. He published in his newspaper a headline, J'accuse, I accuse, where he accused the government of corruption and lying in this case. It took about 10 or 12 years before they finally brought Dreyfus back from Devil's Island and apologized to him and restored him his rank as in the French army and all that crap. But because Dreyfus happened to be Jewish, mm-hmm. and the Rothschilds took up this case in the French press, it became a worldwide case. And on the day that Dreyfus was drummed out of the corps, you know, where they rip off the patches, and there was a crowd there, and they were shouting anti-Jewish slogans, allegedly. And a journalist in the crowd, Jewish journalist, Theodor Herzl, that was the moment at which he arrived at the idea that the Jews had to have a homeland. And that is the birth of Zionism.
Right, right.
1890-something. So there's no way in hell that Albert Pike would have known about Zionism. The term fascism was actually first used by Giovanni Gentili, an Italian philosopher, and later picked up and popularized by Benito Mussolini, another intellectual, and others like Julius Evola and Gabriele D'Annunzio, a very popular poet. And the first time the term fascism was really used in print was in 1926. So, I mean, Mussolini's March on Rome was in 1920. So there's no way that Albert Pike would have known about this. Now, communism, yes, that existed. Communism, the term communism was already in use in the 1850s because Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels had popularized it in Europe. But what I'm getting at is if you look at the Pike-Mazzini letter, you could see it's a very clumsily contrived forgery. And similarly with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is really more of a plagiarist situation than it's a forgery, but it's also plagiarism because it's stolen from a book called Dialogues in Hell between Niccolo Machiavelli and Montesquieu, the French philosopher Montesquieu. Whole lines were lifted out of it. The version that was put into the protocols was actually written by the Tsar's secret police as a propaganda tool. Not necessarily just targeting Jews, but targeting liberals, socialists, people who would have been considered opponents of the Tsarist regime in Russia. So the protocols themselves were sort of a propaganda weapon used by the Russian secret police and released into the European press as the alleged minutes of a meeting of rabbis, which it doesn't seem likely. But that doesn't change the fact that the ideas expressed in the protocols have validity. So someone should have published them and said, you know, this is what I think these guys are doing. But the document itself is a forgery. So, you know, we're fakeologists. We don't just accept documents at face value. We examine them for internal consistency or inconsistency. If we see glaringly obvious impossibilities in the documents, you know, if you look at the Gleason map and you see that they can't even get the spelling, basic spelling of certain cities correct, and sometimes they have the wrong name of the city in the wrong place. So whoever created the Gleason map clearly wanted to plant those little turds in the punch bowl in this document, because they figured flat earthers would pick it up and run with it. And then their critics would say, look at this. How can this be right? They've got Valparaiso in the wrong country. They've got Rio de Janeiro in the wrong country.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we need to be rigorous and tough. You know the way fake nukes feel is? Analyzing photography and video?
Yeah, that's good.
That's where I want to be, analyzing documentary evidence. Absolutely. And I also want to source it. A lot of this documentary evidence is reverse engineered prophecy. And Joe Atwill explained how they do that. You write a document and you say, oh, this really originated 100 years ago, so it's prophecy. We got reverse engineering of prophecy all over the place, right? And that's essentially what the protocols are and what the Pike Mazzini letter is. So,
The protocols. Did you say the elders?
The protocols of the elders of Zion. The learned elders of Zion. You know, it's, you know, I'm not saying that its content is necessarily invalid. I'm just saying that the document itself is plagiarized from the dialogues in hell between Machiavelli and Montesquieu, which is about 50 years older than the protocols themselves. So it's an example of blatant plagiarism, but also forgery.
All right, Lynn. Well, we've hit about an hour, and it's been a good show. Very interesting. I appreciate it.
And by Albert, I should say about Albert Pike, he bears closer examination because he was a very important general in the Confederate Army, and his assignment was to organize the tribes of Oklahoma and Arkansas in a rebellion against the Union. That is to say, to enlist certain tribes as allies and friends of the Confederacy. Just how successful he was at that is another question, but... also, of course, Grand Master of the Scottish Rite, author of Morals and Dogma, and pretty much the most important Freemason in American history. They still have a statue to him, or they took it down finally, I think. They had a statue to him in Judiciary Square right there in Washington, D.C., in the middle of everything. I understand it's been removed because he was a Confederate general, so, you know, and they're out of style now.
All right, Lynn, very good. And any other shows on that you're going to be on this week?
No, you know, this is the only one I do on a regular basis.
All right, I appreciate that.
Hey, I want to say about Ingrid over at RBN and her show on Saturday nights.
Okay.
Because this is a subject I really want to tackle.
All right, go.
All right, so I know all you this argument about Jews versus Jesuits, right. All this stuff.
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned, the primitive, repugnant practice of compulsory male infant circumcision, a tribal practice, is barbarism.
Yeah, I agree.
And to her credit, Ingrid on RBM has been tackling this. And I know people get into this thing about, well, you know, Jews, anti-Semitism. As far as I'm concerned, this circumcising of babies without asking them first is a crime.
Are you an intactivist?
I think, well, I have to say this for the Muslims. The Muslims' practice is to wait until the young boy is about 9 or 10 years old.
Yeah.
And then if he wants to do that, have that done as an expression of religious commitment, he can make that decision for himself. I respect that a lot more than what Jews do with babies who have no say in the matter. Male babies, some of whom, you know, I think psychologically and, of course, physically are damaged from this completely unnecessary procedure. And the origins of how it became standard in American medical obstetrics, that's kind of, we can have a discussion of that. It's history and everything else.
Yeah.
But to me, this is an Achilles heel. This is an Achilles heel with the Jews, is this question of circumcision. It is barbaric.
We should have no hesitation
in denouncing it as such. And shaming them for it. Because it's primitive, it's tribal, and there's no excuse for it.
But I tell you, once you lose the tip, you have no idea what you're missing, literally, and there's no way to re-simulate it. So
yeah, I have no way of knowing that. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
The Greeks and Romans were so offended and shocked by this. It's, you know, they admired the Jews for some things. Like the Jews did not abandon babies that were born deformed. They simply said this was God's judgment and God's punishment on the sins of the parents. And so they kept them alive, right? Whereas the Greeks and Romans would be more likely to take a deformed baby and, I don't know, abandon it, kill it. So they did admire the Jews for that. But one thing that the cultured, educated, civilized Greeks and Romans that really offended them was this what they considered mutilation of the male body by Jews, you know, at the earliest possible moment. And the Emperor Hadrian outlawed it, and it led to a violent rebellion. So I don't know. Could we outlaw this? You know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're doing something without that infant's consent. And that is offensive to me because I believe in free will. Anyway.
All right, Lynn, thanks a lot. And Lynn at fakeologist.com. And don't forget, this is value for value. If you like this show, fakeologist.com/donate. All right, Lynn, have a great night.
Be care.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining. Tomorrow, Fake Nukes Phil. He'll be back. He's back every Wednesday. Call in. We might have a couple controversial callers. They promised to call in tomorrow. Let's see. Take care.